The Sunstone Foundation presents The Beautiful and the Darned, a meditation on pop music and morality, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
We hope more will dwindle in. We know the hour is early, but we don't want to short these two gentlemen on their thoughts that they are going to present to us, which I think is a most timely issue. Michael Hicks, I won't go into a lot of detail so we can have the time for the papers. He is a very talented musician who is an assistant professor of music now at the Brigham Young University. And his paper is entitled The Beautiful and the Darned, A Meditation on Pop Music and Morality, which I think is the most timely issue as a teacher of seventh graders. I am overwhelmed when they bring their ghetto blasters, as I have listened with them, to the words and have been terribly embarrassed sometimes as I have listened to the words, which I have many times not paid that much attention to, and really am very interested to hear what these men have to say on what effect this does have on our young people today. And in response to him will be Michael McLean, who is a songwriter. He produced Mr. Kruger's Christmas, wrote the music for us that many of you are familiar with, and he's the senior writer at Bonneville Media Communications. I think we are most fortunate to have two such talented men right here amongst us to present this timely issue to us. And I will turn the time over to them, and after they finish, we'll have time for questions from the audience.
I begin with this epigraph from Cole Porter's 1927 song. They say that spring means just one thing to little lovebirds. We're not above birds. Let's misbehave. There is nothing new under the sun, lamented Solomon. Surely pop music and morality, this book you may have seen by Alexei Azevedo, like the mischief it seeks to expose, is part of the nothing that is new. Yet it is a book that is not altogether unthoughtful. It can help one to think. Fortunately, like most gift books, it has those nice wide margins in which to inscribe one's thoughts. And like most gift books, between the margins, it is a small book indeed. But it is a book that should not be dismissed lightly. It must be dismissed heavily. For this book is another ill-dispatched spear in the crusade against the life of the senses, a holy war that has gone on at least since the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. One could probe this book in the fashion of a book review and the articles and speeches and pamphlets in its proximate orbit, lyric by lyric, title by title, song by song, critiquing their judgment of the message and intent of each word moaned over a microphone in these last days. But that is merely a nice parlor game, one to indulge with friends after the tracts are read and the margins are full. For now, let us seize these tracts mid-flight and consider their message and intent. For I believe that what more than one of them delivers in its concept of morality is what I call denatured Mormonism. In denatured Mormonism, Eros has not only been ousted from heaven, he's been banned on earth. Sexual desire is carnality. Sensuousness is sensuality or devilishness. Sex overwhelms, embarrasses, and frustrates. So it cannot be from God. This is the assumption. When sexuality is transformed into words, music, or dance, veiling its face, as it were, it teases all the more. In denatured Mormonism, sex, its chemistry and its mystique, are just part of the devil's plot. A favorite rhetorical implement of denatured Mormonism is the opposition of love to lust. De Azevedo himself uses it in the book, the dividing line, he says, between noble, uplifting love songs and degrading lust songs can be very subtle at times. In the typical formulation, I think love is a kind of holy concern, while lust is mere sexual desire. Love is compassion, lust is mere passion. So simply have love and lust been divided in denatured Mormonism. Our whole system of marriage, that cultural sanction of sexual intercourse and its effects, shows contempt for the dichotomy of love and lust. Marital love must be preceded by and accompanied by a strong sexual desire, a kind of lust, if I can use that term, for the partner. And sexual passion must be accompanied by care and respect. Mating, perhaps Mormonism's highest value, is not the triumph of love over lust, but the amalgamation of quote-unquote lust into a broader conception of quote-unquote love. Marriage is, in part, a covenant to maintain that amalgamation and breadth of love with one's spouse. Erotic sensations are not repressed, but indulged with one's mate in the euphoria of intimacy and intercourse. The nuptial celebration itself, in which the couple is blessed by the community henceforth to enjoy one another bodily and to create other bodies, is essentially an erotic ritual, not a reluctant concession to the devil. Now, Solomon, as you know, wrote a huge erotic song about marriage and its pleasures to celebrate the sexual relations he was apparently so adept at. Although some Mormons, including, may I say, Joseph Smith, find the book not inspired, that is, they wish that more plain and precious parts had been expurgated, we do have it in the canon, so far as it is translated correctly. Carly Simon sings Nobody Does It Better, and we threaten to ban it. The difference in our attitudes may be accounted for in several ways. First, Solomon is older, hence more sacred. The weight of history and tradition tipped the scales to his side. Second, Solomon is a man. A woman singing about sexual relations, however obliquely, can stir in the dominant male a certain terror of his own love hatred of Eve, that temptress who is also the mother of all living. Most importantly, though, children listen to Carly Simon and never read Solomon. She sings openly while Solomon sleeps between the pages of Scripture. The popular song constitutes for denatured Mormons a far more dangerous eroticism, for it admits Eros to the company of the unmarried, where in spirit, as you know, he has always been. If the Garden of Eden tale says anything, it is that what is forbidden becomes our obsession. And sure enough, the affections of marriage forbidden to the unmarried have always cropped up in popular music. Reading Pop Music and Morality, I was struck by how tired many of the daring lyrics of today really are. But many of the songs that are mentioned in the book are what are called it songs in the book. That is, it, the simple pronoun, is used to hide something far more dangerous. Beat it, whip it, so on. Well, the most flagrant it song of the 20th century, of course, is Cole Porter's 1928, Let's Do It. Birds do it, bees do it, even sentimental fleas do it. By the way, the original lines were chinks do it, Japs do it, but that was thought too offensive. Remember that by 1930 had appeared Just a Gigolo, Forbidden Fruit, Love for Sale, and the astonishing I Want to Be Rated by You, whose chorus says, I'm a nightclub queen and rather obscene, and I want to be rated by you. References to making love, a long-standing double entendre, abound in the music of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. Billy Joel's Only the Good Die Young, which Pop Music and Morality calls a sermon for immorality, is hardly more blatant than Let's Misbehave, 1928 hit for Irving Aronson and his Commanders, which I quoted at the beginning. Let me read you the passage from Joel and then the passage from Irving Aronson and the Commanders. Joel, come out, Virginia, don't let me wait. You Catholic girls start much too late. But sooner or later it comes down to fate. I might as well be the one. Now, Cole Porter, you could have a great career, and you should. Only one thing stops you, dear. You're too good. If you want a future, darling, why don't you get a past? Because that fatal moment's come at last. De Azevedo complains about Olivia Newton-John's Let's Get Physical, but apparently sees no connection between its sentiments and those of Ellington and Gaines's Just Squeeze Me, which his mother Alice King recorded in 1947. The Roaring Twenties' Helen Kane popularized I Want to Be Bad, whose words say, when you're learning what lips are for, and it's naughty to ask for more, let a lady confess I want to be bad. Her mantle has lately fallen upon groups like Vanity Six, which is in fact a modern parody of the 1920s group The Three Girlfriends, in their Do You Think I'm a Nasty Girl? Though even the lascivious Kane could not approach the confessions of Vanity's lyrics, I'm looking for a man who will do it anywhere, even on the limousine floor. The treble clef that adorns the dust jacket of pop music and morality resembles an inverted question mark, an interrogative, to which the first response is, there is nothing new under the sun. When we with Solomon have stopped asking what's new, we might ask what's wrong. Although I agree with De Azevedo and many moralists that often modern lyrics promote or at least acquiesce to infidelity and extramarital indulgence. And this, incidentally, is true of lyrics going back to the origins of song itself. Many erotically elusive song lyrics, if not most, are inherently neither promiscuous nor illicit. They celebrate love and desire, which in the abstract are intensely moral. Permit me to cite Parley Pratt, who explained in unmistakable terms the goodness of erotic desire. This is from Pratt's tract, Intelligence and Affection. In all these things, man has mistaken the source of happiness. He has been dissatisfied with the elements and attributes of his nature, and he has tried and sought and prayed in vain to make himself into a different being from what the Lord has wisely designed he should be. The fact is, God made man, male and female. He planted in their bosoms those affections which are calculated to promote their happiness and union, that by that union they might fulfill the first great commandment, namely, to multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it. From this union of affection, this is a fascinating statement, from this union of affection springs all the other relationships, social joys, and affections diffused through every branch of human existence. End quote. This statement, of course, by a man who aspired to the Solomonic order of marriage, represents pure, forgive the pun, unadulterated Mormonism. When the passions are indulged in song, that is, without immoral or covenant-breaking intent, the passions themselves are transformed into another language, a code, with a definite, unique structure. Sex becomes song, is released through that sensuous medium and not through its natural systems. This is as true of 19th century art music as of modern pop. One musician recently remarked to me, in Tchaikovsky, there's an orgasm every 6 minutes. As such, erotic song becomes a useful counterpoint to marital relations and a legitimate vessel for the unconsummated passions of the unmarried. For in Mormonism, the unmarried are wholly destined for marriage by their religion, either the reality or the fantasy of its consummation. To the extent that songs embody the infinite longing of romance, and specifically of romanticism, they corporealize the dreams of young Mormons, for whom marriage equals exaltation. For married Mormons, they make flesh the continuing quest for youth, immortality, and in godhood, fertility. Erotic songs add a layer of polyphony to the act of marital love, and through recordings they often confer an aural halo about the marriage bed, a veil, a canopy, as it were, to the rites enacted there. All of which brings us to the subject that De Azevedo carefully avoids, pop music. Yes, the author does refer to an amorphous power that he calls music, quote unquote. He is what we call in aesthetics an emotionalist. To him, and I quote, words communicate ideas, music communicates feelings, end quote. This dichotomy springs from one of those false dialectics of the love versus lust variety. For words and music are not mutually exclusive in their effects. Both words and music depend on sonority and syntax. Even De Azevedo refers to that old saying, music is a universal language. Words, not just music, can communicate feelings, as poets all know. And music, as all musicians know, communicates ideas. Not verbal ideas, of course, but musical ideas, which, though they speak to a different region of the brain, are ideas nonetheless. If music can communicate either ideas or feelings or both, as I believe it can, then it is indeed a sacral power to be used only with the wisdom and grace of a Solomon. Why then do many young Mormons, including this book's author, choose pop music in particular as a, and I'm using his language, a weapon in the moral conflict of the ages? Because, as they believe, pop is, I quote him again, the language of the people. Despite its name, popular music is only tenuously the people's music. For the style that some trust even to embody religious sentiment springs not from the people, in all the proletarian or folk senses of the term, but from the merchants. Pop music, if anything at all, is an industry, a product that is, in fact, its own commercial. The music is manufactured by trained craftsmen to create specific effects. In folk art, people's art, techniques arise from necessity. Forms emerge from the naive and simple visions of the folk consciousness. In popular art, the techniques of aristocratic art are co-opted into the domain of the middle and lower classes. The techniques, now devoid of the weight of ideas that once necessitated them, are extrapolated and manipulated as pure style. By technological media, the masses are given an appetite for these glossy facsimiles of culture and then invited to consume at affordable prices. When De Azevedo, for example, proclaims himself a musician of the people, he tries to belie the very condescension by which he manipulates others through musical effects. The premise is, the people cannot indoctrinate themselves, someone must do it for them, that is, do it to them. The religious propagandist uses pop music precisely because it was made to be used. It is not the music of the people, insofar as people constitutes a collection of persons, but of the mass. It is an art not created by them, but for them, an art indeed that creates them. Pop music does have moral consequences, but intrinsically, structurally, not really in the prattle of its lyrics, which function as music most of the time anyway, rarely as words. If there is a coherent genus of music that can transcend the relatively self-contained cultures of punk and country western, even a Saturday's Warrior, its dominant trait is redundancy. This is not simply repetition, of course, but needless, obnoxious, and vain repetition. The catalog of pop technique is small indeed, and used to the uttermost. There's the emphasis on pulse, the essential redundancy. Slow harmonic rhythm. Indulgence in primary chords and chord progression formulae. Endless strophism. And that ubiquitous, captivating refrain known affectionately in the business as the hook. All this redundancy works catechismically, constraining thought into proven patterns, inducing a sense of predictability that among the masses may feel like prophecy. Pop music is the inverse of experimental music, which you will hear more of at the 12:30 session, that growing realm of art that seeks to widen perception, comprehension, and speculation. Pop is the art of the tried method. As such, it can, and I think should be, used as a healthy, occasional recuperation from thought. But at the moment it proceeds from antidote to diet, it becomes, for the listener, true self-abuse. This abuse can appeal to modern Mormons for several reasons, I'm afraid. First, the tendency of pop music is to gravitate to the fundamental tones and to the rhythmic fundamental pulse. This seems to symbolize that recurrence to fundamentals mentality, those constant urgings back to basics. Second, the notion of orthodoxy, of holding to standards of thought and of avoiding speculation, may be easily adopted as an aesthetic caveat, a premise whose dictates pop redundancy satisfies quite well. Finally, redundancy itself has been redefined. That is, the needlessness of reiteration has been reinterpreted as a necessity, according to the oft-repeated dictum, we learn by repetition. Though I think that we remember by repetition, we learn by perceiving the heretofore undiscovered. We may, like Jacob, cross the familiar river 1,000 times, but we learn at that moment when day breaks on the shore and we grapple with an angel. Learning requires constant exposure to the new, and it negates the bitter oppression of the routine. If I may paraphrase Ortega y Gasset, we arrive at each new truth with hands bloodstained from the slaughter of 1,000 platitudes. It is redundancy, not music per se, that is the most effective means of indoctrination and which becomes so formidable a piece of the modern propagandist's arsenal. The object of this weapon is not only the human body, but the human mind, and it is the prevailing concept of the mind that is most frightening. In the pop Mormon universe, the mind is a stage that sits silent and bare until its owner decorates and populates it with images. It is, I think, a near vestigial organ, static, blank, and passive. It receives, it is something to be filled, but not something to produce and act. To the propagandist, in this book, as elsewhere, it is messages which have moral consequences, not processes. That is, the means to shape the architecture of the mind are irrelevant, so long as the proper ends are accomplished and the proper content instilled. That redundancy deadens the mind's power to conceive for itself, if for no other reason than boredom, accounts for many Mormon musicians' ultimate faith in pop music. For they feed on a vast ideology that attempts to redesign the mind and the body along utilitarian lines. That ideology includes most of the pop industry itself. It, too, sees music as a tool of indoctrination, and this, in a way, justifies Mormon attempts to negate the preeminent messages of pop, without necessarily justifying the occasional hysteria. But between religion and pop music, more than a war of words is at hand. The chief conflict is between systems of authority. In any one of the separate subcultures that savor pop techniques, the cultural heroes, singers mostly, dominate by the most primitive and hence potent essence, charisma. The crowds that have congregated around solitary figures like Sinatra and Elvis, and consider how their names gain authority by being reduced to single words, or around groups ranging from the Rolling Stones to the King Sisters, have assembled according to the impulses of charisma. Charisma draws the faithful into an essentially spiritual kingdom and governs by spiritual methods. Institutions, which tend to substitute routine for charisma, insisting that the office gives dignity and authority to the person and not the person to the office, are understandably jealous of pop stars. Musical idols seem effortlessly to master their followers, while churches, for example, go great lengths to sustain a far less energetic devotion. Along with these conflicting systems of authority go conflicting myths. One, the myth of the decadent prophetic artist. The other, the myth of the pure prophetic saint. Though the saint has had to suffer from his myth a reputation for a sort of vacuousness and dearth of passion, the artist, particularly the popular musician taking Liszt and Paganini as prototypes, has had to endure a Faustian reputation, the perennial suspicion that his spiritual powers must be the devil's wages. The artist sells his soul to Satan. The saint sells his soul to God, though only in the artist's case does the loss seem notable. So goes the tale that we have all been taught in our mother culture's lap. In a way, the tale is true. The bureaucratic priest and the charismatic singer have both emptied themselves to attain something larger than individual being, both feeling that only by becoming elements in a larger system can they gain individual worth. Their souls consecrated to abstractions and their bodies consecrated to the media, they become living images of the fantasy of their followers to escape from the body and from choice. The audience congregates for a vision of life devoid of the basic terror of aloneness, the fear of existing merely in a torso or a skull, distinct, separate from all else that exists, if it does exist. The content of the message, what the words mean, is only a pretext in popular religion as in popular musical life. The light that attracts people like insects is the meaning of the system itself. Largeness, comprehensiveness, absorption. The author of Pop Music and Morality speaks in his quaint way the desperation everyone feels, as well as the indecisiveness and the hypocrisy. His religious music, that middle-of-the-road pop sound, as he describes it, that enamors so many young Mormons, set against his critique of pop song, articulates a peculiar double-mindedness. Here we have in one a professional pop musician and a persecutor of pop, a composer for the people and a servant of the industry, a traditionalist and a reformer, an artist and, as he calls himself, not an artist. In his demure reluctance to face his professed subject, the music, he probably appeals to the evasive in all of us, for when confronted by all the real questions, we may end up like Solomon, acquiring and lamenting, building up and destroying, writing and writing and writing, only to conclude that all is vanity. Pop Music and Morality, the book, symbolizes what so many of us achingly want to be: slim, casual, ambivalent, thoughtless, chaste. The book is one of the many manuals by which we learn to see the oneness of pop culture and pop cult. Each is a distinct antidote to being what a human is, yet each is a shadow of a larger, deeply human structure of bad faith. The provocation is mortality, the authority is feeling, the method is redundancy, the dream is extinction. Thank you.
I took a speed reading class once. They told me that at the end of the speed reading class, I would be able to read War and Peace in a half an hour. At the end of the speed reading class, I read War and Peace in a half an hour. I think it's about Russia. I'm not really sure, although there were a lot of really interesting issues brought up. You'll have to forgive me, but I really don't understand what Mike was getting at. And some of the things I think I would like to have him elaborate on, but as I listened and try to analyze what was happening here, there's a couple of thoughts that maybe came through, but I may not be bright enough to have gotten the depth of what was going on. At first I thought perhaps the idea, I did understand that he wasn't nuts about this book. The kind of guy that Embryo Music would send out to promote it. But at first I thought, when he talked about denatured Mormonism, I was concerned about, is what he really getting at, that we ought to be able to celebrate sensuousness and kind of have sexier Mormon tunes? Or is what he really leading to the fact that this is really kind of a modern Mormon music man who has rock and roll and the evils of rock and roll kind of the pool table, and his tapes as the brass band that comes and saves everyone. Kind of a, we got trouble in Salt Lake City with the capital MTV, that's rock and roll. Oh, yes, we got trouble in Salt Lake City. Got to find a way to save our children's souls. It wasn't clear. The other thing was the issue of just whether or not this is kind of a helpful effort to say we got an issue out here, and that is that you can't watch Ozzy Osbourne for very long and not get a little bit frightened by the fact that this is kind of scary stuff. And as kids try to face the world, just how impactful and negative and scary is rock and roll, and how do we train and bless and help our children? And there's really two issues going on here. One is there's a guy who's trying to make a buck doing something valuable and meaningful and use his talent to kind of bless the world. And the thing that I think is a little bit scary and that I'm a little suspect of is if you write a book, and I guess I'm jealous that I didn't write it first, because if you write a book that says all of that other stuff is awful, most of it's pretty awful and pretty frightening, so burn those tapes. I just happen to have a couple back here that you might want to listen to that this week only will be for $5.95. And I didn't understand whether or not that was the point that we were getting at. So as I listened to the whole paper and was invited to make a comment, I would now like to make my comment. I think we ought to take as much of the time as is available and ask Michael some more questions about the fact that I think in a little bit more elaborated upon things, we could talk about all of these issues. But I have a comment, and my comment takes the form of a song. Having the opportunity to make part of my living writing songs, and a lot of the people that buy my songs are Mormons, I found that there's a real interesting thing that happens, and that is you have a marketing function within the Mormon community, which is how do you write and create what it is that they will buy. And the real interesting thing is that if people in the LDS community weren't nuts about Saturday Worry and didn't pay tons of dough, there wouldn't be a whole bunch of lookalikes. If what it is that people write touches and communicates and profoundly changes lives, they'll buy it. And I think the point of this book and all the numerous discussions in the Mormon community about popular music and morality really revolve around this issue, taste. How do we help our young people and old people alike develop the capacity to be selective and be careful? Which raises one final issue. Just how scary is rock and roll? And if there was a piano here, I would sing you this tune, although I'm not a great singer, but I will do you the lyrics to a song that really sums up my attitude about rock and roll and its evils and the way young people respond. Okay? This has kind of got a, hey, what's happening, kind of beat that grooves and rocks in its own way. And it kind of has a Charlie Daniels communication. And I will sing the choruses just so you kind of get a sense of why I don't sing on any of my own albums. And the song goes like this. This is based on true experience. You can kind of feel that pulse, kind of grooving, okay. Reason I moved to Heber City, by the way, is so we could live in a place that had chickens and we could teach our kids to walk. Okay, anyway, it goes like this. At a dance at a church house, I was playing with my band when a fella came to give us his request. The dance has hardly started, so of course no one was there, but his request was kind of strange nonetheless. He said he'd heard we'd been hired to play the dance because we'd played one last week down the road. But he said that things were different down at his end of the block, and there was something that we all ought to know, big chorus. Well, you can play some country music. You can play some blue-eyed soul. I like most every kind of music. Yeah, but I won't pay you if you play rock and roll. Rock and roll won't pay you one thin dime if you play rock and roll. Second verse. Well, the kids began arriving. We could tell right away they weren't too crazy about the music that we played. To be honest, we weren't either, but a job is still a job, and if we rocked and rolled, we wouldn't get paid. Well, we were torn because we knew the kids were where they ought to be, and we wanted them to have a real good time. So our drummer started cooking with a rock and roll beat, But we remembered that the check wasn't signed. He said, you can play some country music, yeah. Oh, you can play some blue-eyed soul, doo-doo-doo-doo. I like most every kind of music, yeah. But I won't pay you if you play rock and roll. Rock and roll won't pay you one thing a dime if you play rock and roll. Well, the band took a break and had another cup of punch. And we decided that we ought to find out why. Why a little good old-fashioned down-home rock and roll seemed to terrify this strange little guy? Well, we asked him and he told us it was evil to the core and it made you want to sin the grossest sins. It turns your blood to poison and your mind becomes like mush and you think the sickest thoughts there have ever been. Well, we thanked him for what he told us. We returned to the dance. We played it his way and by 9 the kids went home. As we considered the evening, we learned our lesson well, and so we sang to him as he danced there all alone. We said, we will play for you some country music, yeah. We'll even play some blue-eyed soul. We're not so worried about your children, but it's clear you shouldn't hear rock and roll. Oh, yes, it's very clear you should never hear rock and roll. Go, band! And as the band continues to play out and the saxophone goes, the man from the audience screams, is that rock and roll? To which the group says, no, big band. Fade. I think that for those people for whom rock and roll creates evil, negative, nasty feelings, not just sensuous celebrations of the joys of being crazy about someone in love, I think those people shouldn't listen to it. I just don't think they should. It makes them feel terrible. And for those who find it glorious and exciting and wonderful, and it makes a smile come to their face when the Pointer Sisters sing Jump, I just want to aerobic myself into oblivion. I find enormous amount of joy, and I was kind of raised on rock and roll, and I played in a lot of bands, and I like it a lot, and I think we have to be careful in terms of its content and intent. I don't know what people who write it really had in mind, but I must share with you one final comment, and then we'll let you ask Michael some questions. I was offered a songwriter's deal down at ABC a few years ago, and it was one of the great flattering things in my career. I'd written some tunes, and they'd heard them, and they said, whoa, you write good tunes, son. Get down here. So I went to L.A. They only had 4 or 5 exclusive songwriters, and they were interested in some of my tunes. And they brought me in, and they said, whoa, Michael, you write good tunes, but we want to help you do a little something you haven't been doing too effectively. Now, you have to remember, at the time, I was producing the Mormon Tabernacle Choir broadcast, and I'd written the story for Mr. Kruger's Christmas, and we were getting ready to do all this. And I was basically a pretty gung-ho, as I continue, hopefully, to be gung-ho Mormon. And here I am in Los Angeles with this flattering deal, and the dollar signs are flashing, and I know I'm going to be rich. I don't have to do any more Bob Coast jingles, and I'm thrilled. So this fellow says, we want to help you do what Pete McCann's done effectively. Pete, can you come on in here? And Peter McCann had just made $400,000 with 2 big hits called Do You Want to Make Love or Do You Just Want to Fool Around? And it's the right time of night for making love. And called him in here, and they said, we want to help you do what Peter's done so effectively. And I said, I'm sorry, what's that? And they said, well, Peter had some of your challenges too. Similarly, his father's a Jesuit priest. So he kind of came to popular music trying to tell people what they ought to hear instead of what they want to hear, and that's what we're in business to do. But what we'd like to do is help you effectively do what Peter's done. And I said, what's that? Well, see, Mike, we want you to talk to all of those 14-year-olds in the country and effectively talk to them about doing it in the back of a Dodge, or if their dad's rich, or Mercedes, in a way that's subtle enough that we can keep it on air, but that everybody listening knows exactly what they're talking about and gets their blood pumping, because we're not in the business of talking about what they ought to hear. We're in the business of talking about what they want to hear. And we think if we work with you, perhaps we can help you be as good as Pete McCann. Now, we only have about 5 writers, and we're thrilled that you're here. So let's get to work on some of these tunes with these kind of, your lyrics are kind of, we need to make them more sensuous, more skin, more eroticism. Well, being kind of a denatured Mormon myself, I said, Brother Morgenstern, and I don't think he'd ever been called that before. And I said, you know, if you understood a little bit about my beliefs about where I came from and why I'm here and where I'm going and how much I love my little girl, you probably wouldn't be real comfortable asking me to talk about having illicit sex in the back of a Dodge. I don't feel real good about that. So sit down for a minute. Let me tell you how I feel. Let me tell you what I believe. Let me tell you what I think is sacred and wonderful and glorious, and nobody gets a bigger kick out of a roll in the hay with his wife than I do. And yet, I can't, in all good conscience, knowing where your focus is, I can't do it. Pass. I'll try it some other way. Flattered by your invite, but I'll pass. And I was pained when I walked out because I'm trying to make a buck and I'm trying to maybe make a little bit of an impact. Trying to say things that matter a lot to me and that maybe will matter a lot to other people. But when I understood their focus and their need, their basic attitude was, we're trying to make a lot of money. And if singing songs about what people ought to hear made a lot of money, then they'd be telling me to do that. They're just doing what's making money. And my attitude is that the efforts of Lex de Azevedo and all those people, bless their hearts, I think in a lot of ways, they're trying to offer the best they know how, are alternatives so that young people can at least find a way to find all those feelings that they enjoy and love without the kind of the shroud of things that are awful and negative. The problem is we're not very good. My dad did something very interesting once. He always talked in terms of two things in life. He said, this is the effectiveness part of the scale, and this is the righteousness part of the scale. And he says, this is 0, and this is 100, and this is 100. Now here, at 100% effective and not righteous is the devil. This guy's hot. He gets the job done. He knows how. He's the great deceiver. He is the great liar. He's got armies and this guy cooks. He gets the job done. Very effective guy. Down here at 100% righteous and no effective is J.Q. Milquetoast. Now this guy is good. He does everything like he's told, and he's real righteous. He's a good guy, and he does when he's told, he does it quick, and he's a neat guy. But he's righteous, but he's not getting the job done. The kingdom's not propelling forth. Great things aren't being accomplished. He's just bathing in his righteousness. Now up here, and this is the goal, of course, at 100% righteous and 100% effective, we have Jesus. You have to admit the man's incredibly effective. He got the job done, and he did it with purity and righteousness. Now, as we measure whether it's pop music or the way we live our lives, the big quest is to find out whether or not we're doing real good on the righteousness realm or whether we're doing good on the effectiveness realm. Now, the problem with music, popular music, in the Mormon culture, is I think there's a lot of great efforts in righteousness. We're going to talk about things that matter to us that nobody else is talking about, and eternal marriage and love and encouragement and righteousness and answers to prayers and all those wonderful righteous desires. But the problem is that we're not talking about them well enough or universally enough or profoundly enough or powerfully enough. We're putting all kinds of attention on our righteousness factors and no attention on our effectiveness pattern. Now, what made Cole Porter's songs so great is they were great songs. They communicated what they wanted to communicate brilliantly and powerfully and universally and multi-layered. What happens is in our young culture trying to talk about popular music, what happens is we put so much energy into the fact that it's righteous. Golly, we said that we heeded Moroni's promise. And that's great. But the point is did we universally and profoundly and powerfully at the same time put as much energy into, did we say this very well? Did we say it so that our whole body started to explode with feeling and move? Or did we rely so totally on our righteousness factor that we cheated? And I think the biggest problem in Mormon culture, Mormon arts, is that we're cheating. We're relying on the fact that we said something of value. Therefore, we don't have to say it really very well. We don't have to say it very universally. We only have to talk to ourselves. And I think the big problem is that in our quest to be like the Savior, we need to pay attention to both. And my hope is that as we seek ways, and I don't give as much time and energy to this as I should, But I hope that in my energies, along with the other people who I really have, it's hard to find a market, it's hard to get your product out, it's hard to sell it. I hope that there are ways that we can cheer one another on to find answers to both improving our effectiveness ratios with our righteousness ratios, and in the final analysis, be able to have alternatives, which are not just alternatives because they're different, but because they're competitive. And when we're competitive, we'll be on the radio, we'll be heard, and we'll be talked about. Thank you.
We have about 7 minutes, and I'm sure you've all got some good questions, so I'd ask that when you ask your question, if you would direct it to which one of the mics you would like to respond. Yes?
Good question. Let me answer the second question first. I think that the question is not really so much of the limitations of the elements of pop music, but the limitation of the operations performed upon those elements. That is, the technique of manipulating those few set of items is much smaller, I would say, than 99% of the music that's been listened to in Western history. Now, Asian music and so on has a different sort of aesthetic that, and in some ways is more complex in the operations performed upon even a more limited set of elements. Does that sort of... That gives you at least my opinion on that question. The first part of the question, I think that that Michael's a very interesting and moving personal anecdote about confronting the merchants shows that in fact there is a sense of power by those who control the marketplace on just what people want to hear. I think that one of the issues that has been underlying both of our discussions today is that of modern media, something about which I've spoken a good deal before. One has to ask whether it's simply a matter of people buying artifacts that are in the market, when in fact the media processes that operate, the question is really, do media operate on us? Do media give us appetites? Do media shape our cravings? Do they inculcate desires? And I believe that they do, that simply the processes, the very ubiquity of radio, for example, creates a community and creates a culture in itself. And one of the things that people who are trying to fight against the decadence of pop music, whether from my perspective or from Brother De Azevedo's, Brother McLean's, what comes through is a kind of frustration with ubiquity, a frustration with the plenitude that simply cannot be changed unless you have marketplace power. And even then, one wonders what effect you can have on something that is everywhere present. So I think that beneath discussions of content and of effectiveness is a kind of frustration with a situation we've created we can no longer escape from. Unless we move to Heber.
No.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. No, I mean, I agree with you. I guess if I can make an analogy, since we're talking about pop so much, I make the analogy to pop. If you have someone who is malnourished because they are always drinking Coca-Cola, is it a just and proper remedy to give them caffeine-free Coca-Cola? Simply. And, it's better, I suppose, to eradicate the caffeine, but it does nothing about the problem of nourishment. And it has that for sort of oblique answer. Several questions there. First, I'm not aware of many statements on pop music generally by church leaders. I'm aware of a few scattered statements, and I unfortunately could not cite them for you or say exactly where they are. This book, I think, is probably the major treatise on the subject, and I think probably reflects the views of many. Now, one difference in the approach of this book, and I think in the approach of many people today, and not just church leaders, but many crusaders on this cause that I've seen from on cable news network to the Phil Donahue show, is that they, unlike Michael McLean, do profess to know the intent of certain songs and certain lyrics when they are unclear. That is something that Brother De Azevedo points out, for example, if I can use an example, the song Beat It. The song Beat It, written by that sort of lithe, androgynous youngster Michael Jackson, and used by President Reagan in an anti-drug campaign. Clearly a song that has a very moral message. Leave when there's a fight brewing, beat it. Leave, it's not for you. And if you can understand the words, you usually have to get the album cover to do so. You'll see that there is an intensely moral song, which is being crusaded against by some people because it is said that the true intent of the song is an encouragement to masturbate, that beat it, in fact, is a well-known euphemism for masturbation. Now, you laugh, but this is presented as a... This is presented to state groups throughout Southern California and elsewhere in the country and has made many people suddenly think very badly when they hear that song. And unfortunately, that song now, as little as I hear it anyway, has a certain cast on it that was not there in the song, not there from the author, not there by its usage, but simply there because the moralist put it there. Now, if you may disagree with me, you may think that is actually the intent of the song. But, you know, there is the tendency among many, to get back to your question, do church leaders or whomever speak against pop music through ignorance? I don't know that I could say it's ignorance. I think that we're all ignorant of many things in the pop culture, probably well ignorant of them. But there is a tendency, and I don't know what brings it about, to argue against evidence. It is a conspiratorial mentality that sees in the lack of clear evidence a cover-up. In the lack of something overt by Michael Jackson in that song, there is the need to find something in it, to detect iniquity. And I think that that is a fault common to all of us, I'm afraid, maybe even to church leaders as well.
Let me
turn some time.
Yeah, Michael wanted to respond, and then we're going to wrap it up.
I think the church's main job is anything that leads people away from happiness and joy and truth with God and Jesus is to be frightened and feared, appropriately so. And things which lead people closer to the Lord and happiness and joy is to be cheered on. And I think that when the effect of listening to pop music or seeing the wrong kind of films or whatever gives you a kind of a black, ugly feeling inside and doesn't lead you to the things that bring joy and harmony and happiness. I think the church's position is, well, we don't know, but our basic policy, which has never changed, is if it leads you away from God, it's not good, and if it brings you closer to Him and all the joys that life's supposed to have, hooray for that. And I think that my function is, or my attitude is that if I really am incensed by what's going on, I ought to do something, and maybe my tunes aren't helping, and maybe my little films and my little stories aren't working. But my attitude is at least here's some effort, here's some attempt, hope I can get a lot better at it, and I hope everybody else that joins me in that crusade.